as G.K. Chesterton said, when people stop believing in God, they don't thereafter believe in nothing. They have the capacity to believe in anything, because there's still a kind of story-driven aspect to human life, and you need a story to make sense of life. And I think the problem is that the sort of secular humanist, new atheist sort of story, it doesn't really work for most people. It's not a story they can really live their lives by. And so they naturally gravitate towards, as I say, what are often sort of quasi-religious stories of one sort or another. And the God-shaped hole in that sense will get filled by something, but it just won't be filled very satisfactorily. And you know, for all its faults, the Christian story and Christendom in that sense did have this kind of unifying effect on many people. It gave a shared sense of who they were, their meaning, their purpose, and their identity.
Well, hello and welcome back to Emerging Emmaus. And we have the delight of having Justin Brearley visiting us with us to share about his book and to explore the implications and impact of it, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, Why New Atheism Grew Old and Secular Thinkers Are Considering Christianity Again.
There's a title for you, Neil, isn't it?
I know, it's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? I have to say, I've got to read it to remember it. But the impact of it on me, Justin, over the summer, it was good summer reading. It was great. I've always enjoyed your podcasting and your ability to bring people together from such diverse backgrounds and perspectives, and fearlessly and humbly give them the chance to have it out with each other sometimes, and yet to come to an agreement to differ, to disagree sometimes. But what you're aware of clearly in the book that you've written, and maybe you could tell us a wee bit about it and summarize it for us. But clearly, these years of podcasting have given you so many people that you have listened to and shared with and discussed and debated with, that has allowed you to have a perspective that really helps us up here in Scotland. I don't know if you've been to Scotland before. Have you been up this way?
I have, yes. We have friends who live in Scotland, so we're up there probably at least once in a year. And friends who in Dunoon and elsewhere. So yeah.
Justin, tell us a bit about the book and summarize it for us and tell
sure.
us about it.
Well, as you say, the title is The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, but it could be summarized really in the subtitle, which is Why New Atheism Grew Old and Secular Thinkers Are Considering Christianity Again. So briefly, I've been working in the area of hosting conversations between Christians and non-Christians for all of my adult working life, really. But very much began that work on a show called Unbelievable in the mid-2000s, where I was bringing Christians and atheists together. And this was in the heyday of what was sometimes called New Atheism, a very combative, quite dogmatic form of atheism, riding high in culture, best-selling anti-God books on the bestseller charts from people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens. And you might even remember the Atheist Bus campaign. That was a sort of thing in 2009. There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life, was the logo emblazoned on these buses. So this was the sort of atmosphere at the time of the kind of public discourse on faith. And I was hosting these quite combative discussions and debates on my radio show and then podcast, and in many ways that was a really interesting time. I learned an awful lot. I discovered in the process that actually there's a good intellectual grounding to Christianity, that it can stand on its own two feet, and enjoyed hosting these conversations. But I did notice over time the nature of the conversations changed. So increasingly, as the years went on, fewer of the non-Christians I brought on necessarily identified with this new atheist sort of rhetoric. A lot of them actually wanted to distance themselves from it. They felt it was a little bit shallow, shouty, a bit fundamentalist in itself. And I also noticed sort of from the sidelines, and I go into this in much more detail in the book and the podcast series that now accompanies it, that the new atheism itself sort of had a sort of internal implosion of sorts, as after it had kind of had its honeymoon period, if you like, A lot of the key leaders actually fell out with each other quite dramatically over issues around social justice, LGBT, feminism, that kind of thing. And eventually, I was just discovering more and more people who I think had sort of become disillusioned with the movement. They didn't feel it had actually kind of kept its promises in the sense that it had offered this sort of, I think, slightly naive view that we would have a rationalist future governed by science and reason. And that just didn't materialize. I think in the absence of the Christian story, a lot of other quasi-religious stories actually swept in place of that. And so a lot of I noticed a kind of a new breed, if you like, of secular intellectual coming to the fore who were not dismissing Christianity nearly as quickly as the new atheists did and had very different answers to the questions that their audience had. So these would include people like Jordan Peterson, the Canadian psychologist, who started to draw large crowds of often young men to lectures on the book of Genesis, for 2 or 3 hours at a time. And I was just really interested in this phenomenon. Why was that happening? And he was drawing essentially the same demographic as the R Richard Dawkins and the New Atheists had. Likewise, seeing sort of the emergence of interesting thinkers in the UK, like Tom Holland, the historian, co-host of The Rest Is History, probably the most popular history podcast in the world. And in his book, Dominion, sort of sketching out the way in which there was a sort of, the fact that he had come to realize at an intellectual level that Christianity had really laid the moral foundations of the West and that secular humanism and atheism really were just sort of shallow imitations in some ways, so sort of hollowed out versions of Christianity in terms of their ethical basis. And lots of other conversations with pe similar people who might even go so far as to describe themselves as Christian atheists. And these were people who I think had come to realize that we may be losing something as we lose the Christian story in the West. So that was sort of happening in those sort of interesting intellectual circles. And at the same time, I was sort of noticing this meaning crisis bubbling up, especially among younger people, and a sort of interesting turn of interest towards Christian faith again in certain parts of that demographic. And also just bumping into a lot of interesting people who had had their own sort of experience of encountering Christ as adults. These were often, secular, sort of thoughtful 21st century people, and some of them quite influential thinkers and writers. And it felt like something had really shifted in the atmosphere. So the kind of central metaphor I use in the book is the idea of the sea of faith, which Matthew Arnold, the Victorian poet, wrote about sort of being this melancholy, long withdrawing roar of the sea of faith 150 years ago in the Victorian era. And many people have used that as a symbol of the way in which Christianity has gone out on the West. But when I had a conversation a few years ago with Douglas Murray, the secular thinker, one of these people who describes himself now as a Christian atheist, he said to me, "Well, the thing about the sea of faith, Justin, is it could come back in again." And he was noticing some similar things that I was noticing. And so my proposal really in the book is that I think we may be just at a point where the tide is beginning to turn and people are starting to open up to the possibility of the Christian story again, partly because of the way in which other visions of reality are not bearing the fruit that people hope they would in the West. And I think it opens the door to people listening to that story again. So that's it in a nutshell, really, that I think something's happening. The tone of the conversation has changed. And even though we still see, by and large, obviously church decline continues in many parts of the church in the West, I think that doesn't tell the full story of what's happening as we're seeing this sort of interesting change in the way people are thinking about talking about God in popular culture. And who knows where that may lead in the end.
Sometimes it takes a while for things that are happening south of the border to reach Scotland, and we can be a wee bit slow to catch up in some respects, though in other respects, maybe in terms of Celtic Christianity and getting in touch with some stuff, we can be ahead. But tell us a wee bit about the impact that you've been aware of your observations that you described in the book, Justin. What's been the engagement with your writing?
Well, it's been very positively received, I have to say. I think partly because it injects a note of encouragement into what is often a sort of bit of a depressing kind of picture. Very often, for many people in the church, you feel, oh gosh, it's all going wrong. You know, the trends are all in the wrong direction, and so on. And there's no doubt that there's lots of things in lots of parts of the church that need to be addressed. You know, lots of my atheist friends and in my networks have said, what rebirth, Justin? You know, when you look again at the statistics, it doesn't look that way. And I agree in that sense. I quote all of those statistics in the book. Interestingly, I would say in the past year since the book's been published, there's been a lot of interesting, not just anecdotal, but even statistical data suggesting that there are some interesting things going on in various parts of the church, both here and globally. For instance, it was interesting to see that the Catholic Church in France, very secular country, had, you know, a record number of adult baptisms and confirmations in the past year. It's interesting to see data from Finland showing a more than doubling of young men in church in recent years. It's interesting to sort of see just very recently some data from the US, I think, about the fact that for the first time among Gen Z, the least religious sort of generation, actually the number of young men going to church has overtaken young women, which is an interesting sort of statistic. And lots of other little things, and just lots of anecdotal sort of stories I've heard of interesting stories of a number of churches and church networks that are seeing sudden increase in interest. A lot of young men, especially, walking through their doors looking for something. And yeah, so I do wonder if we might just be starting to see some telltale signs that this opening up, if you like, of people's awareness of Christianity and openness to it might be kind of having an impact now in terms of people investigating and even walking through the doors of church. So it's early days. I'm not a good prophet of these things, but I suspect that there's something going on. But it's probably a very mixed bag as well. There's all kinds of different factors. The more that I've spent time looking into this, especially through doing a sort of a podcast series, that sort of has been going through the past year, cataloguing some of the more recent developments here, the more I'm seeing that there are all kinds of interesting strands to what's going on.
And Ruth, you've worked particularly with 20s to 40s. What's your take on the thesis? What's your take on this possibility that the tide's coming in?
It completely chimes with me in terms of that revolution and of what's happening. We're into almost with the cogs turning. You can see cogs have always been turning, but it's as though, yeah, they're coming back round to engagement again. And there's been a really powerful place for the church as it has been moved from the central point of society out to the margins. And I've always wondered, actually, I think that's probably a place of power for the church where we're humble before God. And I think that's a really good place to be. I do quite a bit of volunteering work through sports chaplaincy with the cycling community in particular. And one of the talks that I heard from someone that was off doing an incredible race, which makes my mind boggle really, but they decided not to continue with the race. And it's a young woman, and she was saying that she then went, rather than racing, went on this journey to discover, and what she was talking about was spirituality. And there was this incredible openness to talk about spirituality, to actually raise the question of what if there is something more? What if this, she didn't talk about new atheism in that sense, nor did she talk about Christianity. But there was that conversation and that thought coming from her about, well, actually, I am curious. What if there is, something else? And if there is something else, what is it? And I love in your book, Justin, you talk about that there's a vacuum that's been created in new with New Atheism, just in terms of meaning and identity. And you see it in our young people, don't you? They're crying out for identity, crying out for what is my meaning in life? How do I fit in? Where is that identity coming from? And as soon as that hunger starts, you can see that there is a need to know. And obviously, God's responding, isn't he? And he's responding in these wonderful ways. And I'm wondering, Justin, as you've been talking with lots of people in this incredible safe space that you hold, to really put on a platform, a public platform, many conversations that are happening in private, on the trains or on walks or in different places, but actually you're able to bring them up and put them on a platform so that we can all hear and engage with them. In that time where you've got the safe space and the tide's beginning to turn, to keep with that analogy with it, do you think that there is this curiosity? Is that part of this kind of that ebb and flow with the tide?
Yeah, I think there is. I think in a way, people have always needed some kind of a story to live by. As I say in the book, the thing that I felt is that over the past century or more now, really, that's the Christian story has gradually been sidelined or pushed out in the West. And but as as G.K. Chesterton said, when people stop believing in God, they don't thereafter believe in nothing. They have the capacity to believe in anything because there's still a kind of story-driven aspect to human life, and you need a story to make sense of life. And I think the problem is that the sort of secular humanist, new atheist sort of story that you're kind of here by accident and you just sort of have to make your own meaning, as it were, it doesn't really work for most people. It's not a story they can really live their lives by. And so they naturally gravitate towards, as I say, what are often sort of quasi-religious stories of one sort or another. And the God-shaped hole in that sense will get filled by something, but it just won't be filled very satisfactorily. So it might be, on the progressive left, there may be, it might be some identity, sexuality, gender identity stuff that's kind of become sacred for some people. It might be on the political right, some sort of political mythology or ideology that, about savior figures in America, whoever, that becomes their kind of particular idol that they put in place of the God story. But none of these stories are meant to fill that vacuum, and they of course end up just bumping up against each other. And I think that's the thing that we're lacking in our culture, is a sort of unifying story that once, and any, for all its faults, the Christian story and Christendom in that sense did have this kind of unifying effect on many people. It gave a shared sense of who they were, their meaning, their purpose, and their identity. And I think that's really lacking in our culture. So a lot of people find themselves sort of, as individuals, floating, kind of free floating almost, without any sense of who they're supposed to be. And a lot of them are being encouraged, a lot of people today encouraged to sort of just invent themselves from scratch. But I think it's actually really burdensome. It's very stressful, especially for younger people, especially in an age when you have to do that and curate it online, in front of all your peers 24/7. I think it's partly why we're seeing this mental health crisis, because it is just such a difficult thing to do. And I think that's partly why, as I say, there's a kind of th these are some of the conditions, this so-called meaning crisis, as the psychologists call it, are enabling an opportunity for people to consider Christianity. Now, there are lots of other options as well on the table. So I think people are still very religious in that sense. We're not particularly less religious than we used to be. We just get religious about other things. And some of that will manifest itself in all kinds of interesting, new age kind of philosophies, spirituality. If you go on TikTok, there's the rise of witch talk now, which is just one aspect of this, where a number of young people kind of dabbling in, charms and spells and hexes and things as a sort of way of trying to control life and to, and I think people naturally gravitate in that sort of direction. And again, in a sort of secular age, we have there's been a real rise, funnily enough, in demands upon, for instance, in the Catholic Church, exorcism for people who have been dabbling in witchcraft or the occult and that kind of thing. So there's all kinds of interesting signs that people are continuing to search for, either in, social settings, culture, or in sort of quasi-religious settings, the something more, the transcendent, that we're kind of primed for it in that sense. But of course, as a Christian, I believe we only find what you're really looking for when you find that in true story, if you like. And I just think that there is, as a lot of those other stories run out of steam and people kind of come up empty through them, I think it does open up the door again for people to investigate the original story, often to their great surprise, finding this story that they thought was irrelevant, outdated, something of their grandparents' generation, suddenly strikes them fresh when they bump into it in a new way. So I've encountered a lot of people who've been on that journey in one way or another, and it's exciting because I think it goes to show that actually the Christian story still has this resonance and this appeal that often it only emerges after people have tried everything else, but actually when they discover it, they suddenly realize, well, this was the thing kind of I was looking for all along, the story that sort of my heart was hoping for. And so it's been lovely to meet, especially over the last year or so, a lot of people who have had that experience of suddenly finding it. And the question is this, are there more, is this happening more often than it used to? Is this sort of, a thing? And that's where I don't know, whether I have data to kind of back that up. But all I know is that I'm constantly surprised at how many people I'm meeting who suddenly are discovering the Christian story is the story that makes sense of them,
Yeah, it's really interesting what you're saying in terms of the alternatives kind of can run out of steam. But one of the areas I'm probably quite aware of is, you're looking for the inner peace. And so people will take up meditation, whether it's mindfulness and yogic poses and postures, and you think, there's evidence to, that there is benefits to this, but actually it's all dependent on you as a person. And when you take it into Christ and when you take it into Jesus, you're suddenly aware that you are not the one that's the, you don't have to self-generate that peace. It's available there. Jesus makes that available to us. And it's just brilliant to hear you talk about these different kind of trends that you're hearing coming through and having the confidence as well to know that when people get curious and when they're looking into spirituality or they're looking into their meaning, that you're there, you, Justin, are there going, well, it's okay if they go and look because others are going to run out of steam and we've got the truth that's sitting here.
And I think that's important, as is to say, I think sometimes a lot of Christians sort of get very fearful of other worldviews or people going off in different directions. I would say what you can take away at a positive level from it is that people are searching, and just as St. Paul at the Areopagus in Athens, when he spoke to the Stoics and the Greeks in this city full of idols, he didn't sort of berate them for their idol worship. He said, "I can see you're very religious in every way. I can see you're searching, you're grasping after something." And I think that should be our approach, in the culture, is just to accept people are on a search, and actually God is there. He's, as Paul says, he's not as far away from you as you think he is. And actually, I've been surprised sometimes at how quickly, when suddenly the lights do go on for people, they suddenly realize, oh, this is the thing I was searching for all along. So I'm quite encouraged in that sense that we are sort of still very religious, even though we often those drives send us off in all kinds of funny directions. Actually, I think God is waiting for us very often at the end of that journey.
I suppose in that respect, it's not surprising the change of tide. It's not surprising that people are awakening to the reality, which we know to be true, that we live and move and have our being in God. Traveling in other parts of the world, like in Africa, the atmosphere is quite different spiritually, isn't it? And you've talked about the Western world we're talking about in particular at the moment, but there, you'll be at a bus stop and you're, or even in a plane or what, and you just naturally talk about faith, and the spiritual world, and what a sense is happening is that eyes are being opened to this spiritual world, which is what you're highlighting, I think, Tristan. And it puts a huge responsibility. Well, we're joining Jesus in what he's doing, of course, but the church, we've to be alert to this. We've to be ready to be able to field the questions and to listen and to love. And one of the things I'm interested, where the rubber hits the road. In the book, you talk about communities of faith that are loving, that are forgiving, that are caring, are sharing, are looking out for the vulnerable, the disenfranchised, those who are seeking and searching. And your wife's involved in a church, and I imagine you are too with your family. Tell us a wee bit about that part of your world and.
Well, I think that you're right. This is where the rubber hits the road, because I think transformation happens, in community. And it's interesting because a lot of the time, a lot of the people I'm meeting and speaking to, about this surprising rebirth, a lot of them are sort of the God question is opening up to them because they're listening to podcasts and watching YouTube videos and going to certain events and these sorts of things. I think, though, my hope is, I think that's great. And there's a lot of interesting prophets, as I say, from outside the church who are kind of pointing people back towards the Christian story through these means. But what I'm my great my hope and prayer is that this actually results in people actually finding genuine Christian community, because it's you won't experience what this is just through interacting with ideas and interesting videos, as good as they may be for kind of pointing you in the right direction. And this is where I think the church has to step up and hopefully, be ready to receive, if they're there, these sort of meaning seekers who are kind of thinking again and reaching out and so on. And I'm, certainly part of a local church. My wife is a minister of a church, and I've certainly seen in our experience, even in the past year, a real sense that actually there's a lot of people coming through the doors with these kinds of questions. And looking for this sense of meaning and purpose and identity. Certainly, I think it's been influenced by COVID. I think there's been a sort of interesting, we all obviously lots of churches have struggled because of COVID and the restrictions and, then trying to sort of come back to in person and everything afterwards. But in our case, and I've heard this in the case of other churches, though it's not uniform, there has been a sort of interesting post-COVID bump, actually, of sort of people who have kind of now looking for a sort of way to make sense of their lives, because that period threw up so many questions for so many people. And likewise, I think there's a sort of an interesting interest even among young people who are not who don't have the interestingly the sort of religious baggage that a lot of older generations have, because they've never been in church and they're never their parents probably didn't go to church. So they don't have any kind of preconceptions that need to be broken down almost. Really interesting sort of conversation I had with someone who works across universities for a sort of Christian university organization, saying that they're seeing unprecedented kind of response on campuses just in the last couple of years that they've never seen before. And doing a survey, for instance, when they asked, non-Christians, if someone invited you to church, would you say yes? And like over 75% saying yes, which is again unprecedented in their experience. There's a sort of, we may not be seeing, we may not feel like we're seeing in lots of churches that demographic, but there's a sort of interesting openness that suddenly emerged. And I've got a 19-year-old son, and again, I get a really different sense in his world from when I was 19 or 20. Of the kind of openness that's around him to spirituality and to even him just being very easy and upfront about his Christian faith, in ways that I would have struggled actually at a similar age, because I just sensed a lot more kind of, I don't know, latent sort of skepticism or hostility. I think that has changed. Something's changed, I think, in that younger Gen Z generation. So I just think there are quite a lot of opportunities here for the church, and the church kind of, has to be at this point ready for this. I give a few suggestions at the end of my book and my recent podcast series as well about what the church can do. And I think one of the things it needs to be is a sort of place where people can bring their questions and their brokenness and everything else, because there's going to be, a lot of people coming in on that tide who are, really confused and hurt and, burned out by the culture. And we've got to be a place that sort of offers a very different answer to that, because the culture can be quite a religious, in the worst sense, place to exist. There's a lot of sort of puritanical people on both sides, left and right. It's easy to get cancelled. It's easy to sort of, but we need the church, as I put it in the book, needs to be a community that counters cancel culture, where we all accept we're all in the same boat. We're all sinners. We've all messed up, but we're all completely dependent on the grace of God, and that should be something that helps us to actually look and feel different to the rest of the world. And I do feel like the church is fast becoming, especially in a sort of digital AI world, one of the few places where people can still find genuine human community, as difficult and messy as that often is. I think it's something that we can offer, which is becoming increasingly unique. And so my hope and prayer is that the church can still be a very much a beacon in that way for helping these people who are looking for this meaning to suddenly discover it in real human community again, with people who are as full of grace and love as Jesus was, to all the different people he met. So yeah, that's my hope, and we certainly try to model that in our own church in our own imperfect way, obviously. But that I think is something churches need to be really ready for.
Absolutely. And I'm sure all our listeners are becoming even more aware of this, that it is where we share the love of Jesus that people really notice and people are drawn. It's a winsomeness, it's a magnetic grace that draws people in. And I'm curious to explore the left right side of the brain stuff, Justin, because it's something that chimed very much with me as I read your comments in the book about McGilchrist, I think it is, and company. And there is the there are these theories that that in both church and culture we have been, with the scientific approach to life and living, been very much left-sided. It's been about mastery rather than mystery. It's about being getting all our ducks in a row rather than being open to what we don't know and growing a humility. Can you tell us a wee bit about your thoughts on that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the person you referenced there, Ian McGilchrist, is a fascinating character who's become very influential, though not necessarily a household name, but still his influence is being felt by lots of different people. He's a fellow of All Souls Oxford. He's a sort of psychiatrist by background, but kind of is multidisciplinary, really. He actually studied theology as well as a young man, and even considered a vocation to monastic life, though he sort of wouldn't necessarily describe himself as a Christian now, but his writing has very much opened up the God question. And he's one of these, again, really interesting intellectuals who are having a really interesting impact on these conversations. So his probably most influential book was one called The Master and His Emissary, published about 10 or 12 years ago. And it really outlined his thesis that the two hemispheres of the brain have historically sort of complemented each other. And lots of people are aware of this kind of simple sort of idea that the left hemisphere deals more with the rational, scientific, logical approach to things, and the right hemisphere is, tends to be associated with the more artsy, imaginative kind of ways of the world. So, the artists are right-brained, the scientists are left-brained. I mean, that's too simple a distinction in McGilchrist's view, because actually most people are a mixture of both. But his thesis is basically that the way the brain is supposed to operate and has operated up until the last couple of hundred years is that the left brain serves the right brain. So the left brain that does the sort of computation and gathers individual bits of data gives it to the right brain, which kind of is the sense-making side of us, and does it in a much more holistic way, sort of through imagination, intuition, spirituality, and everything else. And it develops a vision of the world. But his view is that we've kind of inverted that relationship in the West for the last few hundred years, to the extent that we're now essentially a left-brained culture, and we've kind of somehow this idea that we can make sense of the world by breaking it down into its constituent parts, this reductionist kind of philosophy that especially was exemplified by the New Atheists has kind of taken over. But the problem is we've completely lost actually a real the real kind of human view of what the world is like in the process by sacrificing the imagination, spirituality, and everything else. And he's seeing this as just having in all kinds of, super interesting book, but in all kinds of ways, it's having this deleterious effect on cultures and societies and individuals. He goes into it even more detail in his most recent book, The Matter with Things, which is this huge two-volume thing, which I challenge anyone to get through in its entirety. But it is an incredible sort of look at the way in which this inversion of the left and right brain has kind of had this effect on culture. And interestingly, in that newest book, really opens up the God question, and I think he really sees actually that even the brain itself and consciousness are pointing to a divine source, which is something has been around for a long time in philosophy of mind and that kind of thing, that question. But I think what's most interesting about his work is that he's helping almost on a purely neuroscientific level people to realize actually that we're more than just our brains, that there's an aspect of us that we've lost in Western culture. And prayer is really important, actually. It turns out prayer and sort of seeing things at a spiritual in a spiritual level is actually really important just to being flourishing human beings. And as we kind of systematically push that away, we're actually losing something really important. And so his work, yeah, I think is really helpful in perhaps informing as well the church and Christians, but even people outside, how to recapture something that we've lost. And that is this idea that actually, perhaps one lesson for the church is that we need to go back to capturing people's imaginations, not just their intellect. And that's possibly one way in which we've possibly followed the New Atheists into a bit of a trap where they said, well, we have to see unless you give me scientific evidence for God, basically, I'm not going to believe in God. And the problem with that is that it immediately puts the argument on their terms, this kind of very left brain way of looking at the whole world. Whereas actually most people engage the world actually fundamentally at an imaginative level. And in my experience, most people who become Christians because they wish it were true. Now, there might be an important intellectual aspect to that, where they have to do the left brain thing, but it's usually in response to a vision of reality that they've been inspired to grasp. And then they go and do the left brain thing to make sense of that, to kind of, if you like, justify that. But actually what happens first is actually this imaginative piece where you would want the world to be like this. And for me, that's an important thing for the I've often, I think, been guilty of going straight to kind of people's intellect and trying to force them to believe something through some, philosophical argument for God or, five arguments for the resurrection or whatever. But I don't think that will land unless people want this stuff to be true. They have a kind of an a, you've inspired them to why to in to imagine a world in which this makes a difference, in which this is true. So for me, that's all of that kind of plays in all kinds of ways to our fundamental assumptions about where we begin with a lot of this stuff.
And re-enchantment is one of the words that you use to describe this exploration, which I think is a great word. I remember Irina Ratushinskaya, the Russian poetess, she talked about her conversion as starting in a classroom where there were atheists dinning it into her that God didn't exist, and she thought, why are you repeating this again and again? And she looked out the window, and it was starting to snow, and she said, well, if you're their God, let the snow land and let us have fun with it. And that started her relationship with God, this experiment, this enchantment with the possibilities that attracted her. And she found the New Testament and realized this was the God that Jesus was the one that she was getting to know. this beautiful re-enchantment excuse me. There's so many questions I've got bubbling up. I'm curious about trends in our culture, you know. So, for example, in drama filmmaking, have you noticed any trends? You know, I think of Rev, Tom Hollander, not Tom Holland, of course. Tom Hollander and poor Rev, a miserable and yet faithful follower and wrestling with all his doubts, and there was an integrity there. Clearly, there was someone there, people there behind Rev who knew what it was like to be in a vicarage, and Olivia Colman and Mrs. Vicarage, etc. And we've got Russell Brand, of course, being baptized by Bear Grylls, and all the stories that are coming out of that. We've had Bob Dylan, of course, who had his revelation a way back, you know, a couple decades ago. But are you noticing any trends in terms of popular culture?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, you mentioned a couple there, though. I'd say I really enjoyed Rev as well when it came out, but you know, far more recently, I think it's interesting to see the impact that, you know, kind of more traditionally kind of religious sort of show like The Chosen is having, which has been hugely popular and reached well outside its kind of immediate kind of evangelical Christian demographic. So it's interesting to see, you know, a show like that being doing so well in popular culture. People are still very drawn, I think, to the person of Jesus, and when it's done well, you know, in a non-cringe way, it's interesting to see how many people are engaged by it. Likewise, you know, in popular music, I'd say, you know, there's been a really interesting sort of opening up to the spiritual and to Christian sort of faith, specifically through, you know, if you look at some of the well-known names in hip hop, like Stormzy, you know, sort of being very upfront about his faith. You know, even more recent, you know, Coldplay releasing the song "We Pray" over the summer, full of very kind of not specifically Christian lyrics, but certainly sort of easily interpreted in that direction. Craig David, of all people, just released a song where the chorus is he's got the whole world in his hands, and it's talking about his own sort of coming back to faith, quite openly. And I've bumped into a lot of other similar-ish stories, you know, in the world of music, the world of and I think there are these interesting sort of social media influencers who are being very open about faith. I mean, Russell Brand's a very interesting case. There's obviously still outstanding allegations with him that I think need to be, you know, if justice needs to be done, if there is a case to be answered there. But at the same time, a very interesting example of, you know, someone who appears to have had a very obviously transformational experience. You could add to that, you know, the really interesting case of Ayaan Hirsi Ali. And for me, her story sort of encapsulates really the thesis of my book, though her story actually occurred a couple of months after the book was published, hence not in the book, but certainly I've covered it in some detail in the podcast series, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. And this is the story of a woman who was arguably the most famous female atheist in the world. She was born in Somalia, but fled Somalia from a sort of fundamentalist sect of Islam there, the Muslim Brotherhood, fleeing a forced marriage. She came to Europe in the early 2000s, and very much rejected religion and God, became a very significant part of the new atheist speaking circuit. It was good friends with Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, published her own best-selling anti-God book, Infidel, and yeah, arguably was the fifth horsewoman of the new atheism. There were these so-called four horsemen of new atheism. She was arguably the fifth horsewoman. And then, to everyone's immense surprise, in November last year, she publishes this viral article titled "Why I Am Now a Christian," in which she sort of talks about the fact that she's essentially been converted at an intellectual level by the Tom Holland thesis that that the West is essentially founded on the Christian story, and that secular humanism, she says, is just not equipped to push back against what she sees as the dangerous forces in the world of fundamentalist Islam, or Putin's Russia, China, what she sees as the danger of sort of woke ideologies on the left and so on. And she talked about, the fact she'd embraced Christianity. Now, a lot of people responded, understandably, with a sort of, well, is this just a sort of political, cultural kind of conversion? But she also talked, at a very candid level, both in the article briefly, but also in subsequent interviews about her personal journey. And just that she had sort of reached a sort of a sense of emptiness in her own life, depression, alcoholism, and was looking for meaning and purpose and finding that her atheism just simply couldn't provide it in the end. And it was only after going through several counselors that one of them suggested, well, have you tried praying? And she said, I can't pray because I don't believe in God. The God I was raised with was a monster. And this counselor said to her, well, what kind of a God do you think you could believe in? And she started to describe the God she could potentially believe in. And she says, as she did so, she realized she was describing Jesus Christ. And so she thought, well, maybe I should investigate this person who claimed to be God rather than trying to invent a new one. And so she started going to church and she started praying. And she says it completely flipped her life around. She suddenly the lights came on, and she's now, very much sort of out there, talking about this new Christian faith she has. Shared a stage with Richard Dawkins quite recently to talk about it. And again, it's not that I agree with all of her politics and everything else, but it's very interesting when some, as I say, that's kind of about as much of a kind of Damascene conversion as you can get. It's really is remarkable and suggests that there's something going on, as I say, in the culture. And stories like that, people of that kind of influence are having, I think, are creating all kinds of interest around this. As I say, not all of it's, I'm not baptizing it all or endorsing it all, because some of it is, and plenty of critics have, said this to me, and I think they've got a point, that a lot of these figures who are having these sorts of come to Christ moments are kind of very much on the conservative right wing end of the spectrum, and that's true. But I think the reason we're seeing those characters probably more in the limelight in this area is because they're sort of there's a sense in which they're more primed to have a platform and to talk about this stuff in a way that folk who are more on the left perhaps are less able to. Nonetheless, I'm seeing lots of interesting ways in which this is not just a phenomenon that is a sort of conservative right-wing thing, that it's actually bubbling up across the spectrum, but in different ways, as this sort of meaning crisis hits a lot of different people. So so there's basically, I think there is a lot happening, across different areas, entertainment, arts, these cultural figures, and so on. But we obviously need to be aware of, what that to be encouraged at one level, but also to sort of be able to sort the wheat from the chaff as well. There are some people, I think, who are kind of allied to this movement, but who see Christianity as a sort of useful cultural tool to kind of get back to some sort of version of, a sort of more conservative past that they would like to see. And for me, that project is, I just think that in the end, you're just setting up another idol, really, and it won't work out. But I'm also encouraged that actually there's enough here that actually there's a genuine something genuine of God that's happening, and I think the church just needs to be wise as it seeks to engage with that.
Brilliant. We'll have to be wrapping up. Ruth, we usually like to try and conclude with some takeaways. And Ruth, what's percolating with yourself?
I think I'd need to go around every kind of takeaway shop there is to take them all away because there's so many. I would need all lots of different ones. It's just been so rich. I was aware Logos Scotland did some research recently, and they found that what in Scotland anyway, on average, Christians feel equipped to share their faith and talk with other people about it, but they don't think other Christians will. They think there's a hesitation and a reluctance from others. And I think one of the powers from this conversation is actually what you're sharing, the stories you're sharing, the trends that you're sharing and encouraging with us really dispel that myth. they really cause it to come crashing down in sense of, yeah, people are ready and are also sharing their faith. This reluctance, it's God's dealing with that reluctance by letting us know there is a change and people are talking. And so that's great. I love another takeaway is just about that whole engagement again with the imagination. Jesus used parables that inspired imaginative thought and response all the time. And I just really value that reminder and that noticing from you about to continue to engage with the imaginative and to enjoy that mystery that it has such a key important place in our faith and in mission, isn't it? And sharing the faith. And I think where I'll land, Neil, I told you I had lots. Where I'll land. You talked about reductionism, and I recently came across a quote that just says, rebel against reductionism. And it's so good for the church to continue in that way that you were describing about being countercultural, that community that offers the belonging that people are longing for, but doing it in a way that is countercultural by rebelling against reductionism. Love it. So many amazing takeaways. There really are. And I know that Neil will have a whole gazillion of them as well, don't you, Neil?
Oh, it's been fantastic to catch up with you, Justin, and it's just encouraged me no end, as has your book, and this growing awareness and appreciation that the living Christ is at work, and it's and his spirit is opening eyes to who he is, and opening it, hopefully our church's eyes to the opportunities, to the let's not be fearful. That's one of the things I love about your podcast and just your whole approach. As I said at the beginning, is this fearlessness to enter into the fray and to be a peacemaker as well, but to be to be firm in what you believe and what you are growing in understanding. There's that humility that that you share, and I really encourage you and affirm you in that, and appreciate your role that you have in particularly the UK and our Western Christianity, as you encourage us and help us to engage with culture, to engage with the ideas, and the fact that it's rooted and growing in a local situation encourages us as well. It's well rooted and grounded. So thanks so much for being with us, and when you're up this way, Dunoon way, I'm not far from there. Let me know when you're coming up that way, and I'll cycle over, and we'll get a cuppa together. It's fantastic. Thanks so much
Pleasure.
for sharing with us, Justin. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ruth and Neil. It's been lovely to be a guest on the show.
Thanks everybody for joining us. Go well. In your neighbourhood, trudge two dumped Jesus friends, drowning before dawning, moving through a maze of misery to an amazing Emmaus encounter. Emerging Emmaus.
Good grief, our dream is dead. Going home instead, comfort of my bed.
Good grief, the pain. Hope hard to sustain, love down the drain.
Good grief, where have you been? What we've seen? Blown to smithereens.
Good grief, how our hearts burned, our minds turned, all we learned.
Good grief, don't go away, come in to stay, you've shown the way.
Good grief, how he broke the bread with hands that bled, then disappeared.
Good grief, Jesus alive, no need to strive. Chance to thrive, Jesus alive.
Good grief, no time to waste. Now we have a taste to Jerusalem with haste.
Emerging Emmaus, a well-kent lament echoes through the years. How long, how long? Good as is the grieving process, may it be a means to access visions and dreams of Christ's kingdom come. Emmaus. Emerge from the gloom. Come, Holy Spirit, come.
So for future podcasts, join us via the Sanctuary First website, Facebook page and app, and also via Spotify